You can hear me? Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Kelly Pinkleton. I'm the director of the Voting Rights Institute in Secretary Bruner's office. And I want to welcome you all to this is kind of the first work group session of the day. It looks like a good group. I'm going to explain a little bit about the format, kind of the flow. Hopefully everybody is in the correct workshop. This is the poll worker recruitment and training workshop. This is meant to be an interactive work group session. And I'll explain interactive, although I know with most of this crew there won't be an issue. Interactive means we expect you to talk. The only caveat to that is you have to stay on topic. We have kind of three main issues we're going to go through. You will have to be brief because I expect we will have a lot of comments and thoughts and suggestions today. But we do expect this to be interactive, give and take. Essentially, the issues and questions that we're going to talk about, I'm going to be putting out there to you all. We have a fantastic panel, the experts, if you will. But we want to hear from you, your suggestions and thoughts. I do want to recognize Eric Nicholas, one of our regional liaisons, is going to be taking notes today. So he may kind of hold you up if you're talking really fast, just so he can get that down. We also are going to be taping. With that, I will go ahead and get started. And I'm going to first introduce our panel all at once, and then I'll have them each say a couple words. I'm going to start on my far left. We have Kathy Worley. And Kathy is a member of the Pickaway County Board of Elections. Next to her, we have Thad Hall, Assistant Professor, University of Utah. And next to Thad, we have Deborah, or Debbie, Quivy, the Athens County Board of Elections Director. And next to Debbie, we have Quinn Monson, and I did pronounce that right. Good. Quinn Monson is the Assistant Professor of Political Science and the Associate Director of the Center of Elections and Democracy from Brigham Young University. I'm very pleased to be facilitating this session. I'm pleased to have this panel here. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and start right here with Quinn, have each of them say a couple words about poll worker recruitment and training. Quinn?
Sure, I'm happy to be here. And I just add that I've had a bunch of experience in Ohio elections. We got to conduct some exit polling and poll worker surveys in, and especially poll worker surveys in Cuyahoga County in 2006, in Summit County and Franklin County in the general election of 2006. The Cuyahoga County poll worker survey was in their May primary. And then more recently in 2008, in the March presidential primary, we worked with Butler County and Delaware County to survey their poll workers and study the implementation of the online poll worker training that a group called HAVA Partners helped develop with the Secretary of State's office. So that's where I'm coming at this from, is a lot of surveys and focus groups conducted with Ohio poll workers, also with Texas and Utah poll workers. And so I'll hopefully bring some of that to bear on these issues today.
Thanks, Quinn. Debbie?
Okay, thank you. I'd first like to thank you for asking me to be on the panel. I feel that it's a pleasure. And whenever we talk about poll workers, I have to think about teamwork, and I have to acknowledge my sidekick, Penny Brooks, because we have to do this as a team to make it work for poll workers. One of the things that Penny and I implemented that we felt was really productive with our poll workers at training, we take all of our equipment. We're an optical scan. We take our M100, our ballot can. We take our auto mark. We take everything. We set up just like we are now, as if you were at a polling location. There are four full-time employees in our office. Each one of us takes the place of a judge, and we go through and let our poll workers do this. We noticed a big improvement in our poll workers when we had them do this because it was more like a hands-on experience. One thing we'd like to do is start recruiting more students. We have students, and that's a wonderful thing, and I'm not sure where to start, but I feel it would be really beneficial if we could get the schools to close on Election Day. We're going to go to all the superintendents in our school. Penny and I are going to start that. I know, I'm excited about that too. We already have one superintendent where we have 8 precincts at a school that is really considering doing this. If we could get the schools to cooperate with us, look at the wealth of students we would have in the high school, look at the polling locations we'd have, and look at the teachers we'd have that would be poll workers. So I would really like to see us. I know Gallia County, I don't know if they're in here, they sent me an email. One of our board members, her husband teaches in Gallia County, and they're going to close their school in November. Their school's on that day. So that's something as a county we want to work on, but as a state, I wish we could work on it all together because I think it'd be beneficial. Probably my biggest concern with poll workers, as we all have concerns with provisional ballots. We were very fortunate in November. We only had about 7% of our provisional ballots that did not count because we have really strived this to our poll workers. The largest number of provisionals we had that didn't count was because of not being registered. The next number was because of poll worker error. So we really feel that that's an area we need to work on with our poll workers. They do a wonderful job, but to try to implement this so that we have this where they don't vote or, you know, have people vote in the wrong precinct. So that's something we really want to work on. So I hope we can all work on all these things together.
Thank you, Debbie. Thad?
So the odd thing about this panel is you have 2 political scientists who are both from Utah talking about poll workers in Ohio.
What are the odds?
Exactly. I like Quinn, come to this. I worked on the National Commission on Federal Election Reform in 2001 after the 2000 election, and from that time, we've recognized that poll workers are kind of the street level bureaucrats in elections, and so just like you were just referring to, they can make little mistakes that result in people not being able to vote or having their ballots invalidated. I've worked with Quinn on several of these survey projects, and we've also done national surveys through some projects that are funded by the Pew Charitable Trust, and I did a survey for another project where we surveyed 3,500 people in Ohio regarding their experiences in the elections, I'll talk about that tomorrow, but part of that was also looking at the poll worker experience. The 2 points I wanted to make is, one is that when you look at across states, one of the things you see is that the way that people do training and the administrative tools that they give poll workers in polling places makes a tremendous difference. So to give you an example, in 2006, we implemented a DRE system just like Cuyahoga County did, but in a primary election, but we had a very different experience in part because we had very different training procedures in place and different manuals and documentation, I think, that made that procedure work smoothly. We also got to go second, which helped too. So we got to see all the issues that arose the first time. And the second is that, when you think about training, it may require thinking about training very differently to accomplish what you want to do. And so, doing hands-on training may provide different sort of experiences for poll workers compared to having larger sessions. So actually making them interact with machines, technology, putting them in scenarios, provides a different experience.
Thanks, Thad. Kathy, before Kathy starts, I do want to make sure everyone knows a sign-in sheet is circulating. If you can please make sure and complete that. And when you're, when it gets to the back or everyone's signed in, just make sure I get that. Thanks. Kathy?
Thank you. I've been to training myself in more than one county and have worked in multiple polls. And would like to go on record as one of the people at this conference who is very much opposed to the voter identification law we have now. I'm hearing a lot of support and a lot of feeling that it has given more trust to the system, and I don't think it's added trust to the system. I think it's made it more difficult to train and recruit poll workers, especially to get presiding judges. Because when you have some law like that that is going to end up disenfranchising so many people, you have to have so many exceptions to the law that it just creates a lot of difficult rules. So no matter how much we want to simplify and streamline the process, it's very difficult to do when the rules are going to be so complex. And that is the reason we have so much provisional balloting, I believe, when we're at the polls. And it's also the reason we get off track and have poll workers having people oftentimes voting at the wrong places because they're so hung up on so many of the rules that they're losing sight of the most important initial question, which is, what is your address and where is that address on a street finder or a map? And I think those are 2 tools that need to be very good tools in every county. I think the online training and any additional kind of training we can make available is important when we look at all of the
everyone enjoying the sanctity of their own home and getting online to buy what they want and to do everything else. Training there is absolutely crucial, but I think the one thing now that things are so complex we have to do a lot more of in our training is role-playing. And, you know, I can talk forever. I totally enjoy public speaking. I was a trial lawyer for 25 years, but you'll find most people do not like public speaking. You're going to have to figure out a very fair way of forcing people to do the role playing that does not involve volunteering, because the ones who volunteer already know the answers or they wouldn't be volunteering. And I think the other issue that needs to go into the role playing is one of your biggest issues that I think is one that comes across when voters are interviewed on how they fared at their poll, and that is how were they treated? And how were they treated when there were problems? Or how much tension did they feel when someone had a problem and how was that problem dealt with? And the role playing really needs to deal with the second thing that people don't like. You know, most people have real problems with the public speaking and the role playing. The second thing is they have real problems with confrontation of any kind. So when someone comes in and demanding to vote, they have a real problem, and you need to, in your role playing and your training, deal with how do you deal with the problem people? How do you deal with somebody who's irritated when they're being told this isn't your correct polling place, or they're being sent home to get ID? I had to send one of my poll workers' husbands home to get an identification recently. I mean, one of the reasons I have the problem with the identification is because its purpose is to weed out fraud, and I think it's not weed in the two counties, one very large, one very small, with which I have familiarity. It hasn't weeded out any fraud. It's just complicated the process, but the role playing can in part deal with this. You don't have to be confrontational. It can be dealt with in a very slow down and deal with it in a meaningful way. One of the polls, I was presiding judge for the Bush-Kerry campaign. I had the entire day in the rain, a 3 to 4 hour wait all day long. And this was before the ID issue, but still, you can still slow things down and have your poll workers certainly learn to do that. And there were two things in the report. One is Butler County has all of their, in their training, they have everyone fill out a provisional ballot, which would, you know, I wonder if all your poll workers have before they get to the poll on election day actually filled out a provisional ballot. And I thought that was an excellent idea. And the other idea I liked in the poll worker section in your report is when you do have errors, to look to see if you have consistency with a lot of errors in a particular precinct or polling place or ward, so that you can target where you need to make sure you've got someone in there and knows what they're doing with all of the provisional ballot and voter identification rules, that they understand them and can more easily enforce them and deal well with the public.
Thank you, Kathy. So with that, we're going to go ahead and expand the panel, and you all now become panelists as well. With the poll worker recruitment and training work group, there's about four main issues that were pulled out from the summit in December. The first one deals with recruitment, and I believe you all have a handout. Some of the key themes we want to hear from you on, and the panelists will also speak to. Counties in the state formally partnering with civic organizations, nonprofits, working with schools to gather and recruit new poll workers. We want to get your ideas and thoughts on what that partnership could look like. I know in some of the counties, and we have some organizations here that already have those partnerships. If you would like to provide us some suggestions or ideas, or the panel would, on other ways that we can look at the county level and the state level, recruiting and developing future poll workers. I know that you all have probably heard average age of a poll worker is 72. So we need to look at, you know, recruiting and developing, you know, future generations of poll workers. So with that, I will open it up to the panel and or audience.
Just you said the average age of a poll worker is 72, and just wanted to point out that I don't know where that statistic comes from.
Somebody because made it up.
I don't think it's true. In the Ohio counties where we've collected data, it ranges anywhere from the mid-50s to the mid-60s on average.
Isn't that the national statistic?
But there's no national data that underlies that statistic. So whoever said it's 72, I don't know where they got that. So just to be sure.
I got it from the New York Times. I'll give them a call and let them know that.
Yeah.
It's an urban myth, though. It really is. Like, somebody was asked and they just made it up.
Thad and Quinn, all the way from Utah, to dispel the myth.
So, but to start to answer your question, I think I would offer two things. One, here in Franklin County, we got to observe in 2006, and I assume they did this in 2008 as well, their Champions of Democracy program, where they interact or they use local corporations and unions and others to help, and schools to help recruit poll workers into their county poll worker pool. I think they've had a lot of success with that, and in fact, in the data that we gathered in 2006, we were just able to compare the first-time poll workers that they recruited through that program with their, what we would call their legacy poll workers. And they are quite a bit different. They did succeed in getting younger, more technologically sophisticated. They had a lot more computer savvy and experience, and I think that helped them. So I would point that out as a good model. And I'm sure there's other counties doing similar things. The one problem with that kind of program are the concerns that it raises about sponsoring a polling place, and especially when there's a ballot initiative on the ballot that involves a corporation or a union or potentially could. I think that has the potential for a real conflict and could cause some heartburn on the part of voters, you know, having a polling place sponsored by a local corporation that has an interest in the outcome of the ballot initiative or something like that. But if you can figure out a way to recognize those participants without unnecessarily promoting the position of some corporation or a union or something, then I think that's a helpful way. The other thing I would suggest that is a major untapped source of new poll workers is your own voter file within your county. And so every county has their own voter file that has all of that information on how often people voted. In our poll worker surveys, we find that while the money that poll workers get paid is appreciated, none of them are under the illusion that it properly compensates them for that long day. And so that's really not why you got them in the first place, at least for most of them. They're there because of a sense of civic duty, and because of the social interaction that they get to have with other poll workers and with voters. And so what you want to do, I think, what would be helpful is to try to mine your own voter file for purposes of poll worker recruitment. Because you know where they live and you know how often they vote, and you would think that the sense of civic duty that one feels is probably correlated with the fact that they vote all the time. And so if you were to do a little bit of basic cutting of that file by, you know, people that have voted in the last X number of elections and who live in the area of your county that is in need of more poll workers, that would be the group I would isolate to then target for some kind of communication, you know, if you can get enough for a mailer or something to recruit poll workers in that area. So you could narrow down to the very precinct that you need the list of the 50 people who have voted in all of the past 10 elections or something. And then you can take everyone who's 65 and above, don't ask them, and go down and ask the younger, regular voters if they'll be a poll worker and see how that does. I would imagine that would produce some effects, and I'm interested in studying that if somebody else is interested in it.
From the audience, yes, Judy. And if folks will, when they stand up, just say first name and where you're from or your organization, that would be great.
Judy Miller, I'm director of Claremont County. We had the same problem that everybody else did, and I became a new director on the primary election day of 08, and so I had a big challenge getting ready for November because I knew it was going to be on my shoulder. So I sat down and I prepared an agenda of how I was going to find poll workers, and I started out with the idea of targeting these organizations, the PTOs, the garden clubs, the rotaries, the influential organizations within the county, the Chamber of Commerce. And then I started contacting these people from the Chamber of Commerce and these young leadership groups, and everybody was very enthusiastic, but then when it came down to them supplying me with poll workers, they never came through. they energized me to keep going because they were so enthusiastic, but when it was come time to, you know, get the people up to the plate, it wasn't happening. So here I was down to July, and so I was having to twink this agenda, so I wanted to stick with my agenda, so I said, what's this all about? It's marketing. How do candidates get elected? Marketing, advertising. So my then went into a two-phase process, and I had to do TV advertising and to get a mailer out somehow. So I went to my board, and I was able to get $3,000. I was able to work out with our cable company, which is a cheap way to advertise and has a lot of response, is cable TV. We put together a tape, and we said, how are we going to get these people, the target people that we're looking for, the young, the vivacious, to get new blood in here? So the people that we used in our commercial was the soccer moms, a teacher, a community business person, people that other people recognized in the community that they would relate to. And so we moved forward with a TV commercial. I don't know, did you see our commercial? We did a TV commercial that ran on 6 cable TV stations, and then we also did a flyer that just about the entire county is on a central water system, and it's billed by the county. We prepared this little flyer that went in every water bill, advertising, become a poll worker. We pay at least $130, because when we get these new people, not only do they get their $95, which is higher now, for working as a poll worker, we give them $25 for the training, and made it a little bit lucrative for them to be a poll worker. So we sent these flyers out. We ran those commercials the last 2 weeks of August, and we generated over 200 people in a week and a half. Those phones were flooded. Now then we had to weed out. The real problem we had is we had so many people that responded to that commercial and those flyers in the water bill that we had to start weeding out. We had people that were upset because we didn't have them work as a poll worker. So that was a real problem. But still, again, we still, so many people, like teachers, don't want to be poll workers, even though this is an ideal group of persons, because they're used to teaching every day, working with rules and directions and how to get people to do things. They're a great pocket, but they don't seem to want to grab on to become a poll worker, as we found. But we still did generate a lot of good people out of that, and so, you know, marketing was the answer we found, and I'm going to stay with that.
Thank you, Judy. And also, one of the issues for discussion, too, and we've already touched on it a little bit. I know Quinn did, and Judy, you touched on it. Not only various recruitment efforts and partnering with organizations, but looking at different types of poll worker models, increased compensation, if it's split shifts, any of those. So we want to hear from you on that as well. Yes. Can everyone hear her in the back, or do you want to use the microphone? Yeah, right there. Thank you.
I'm an election activist, and I have been working on a hand count of paper ballot initiative that has nothing to do with this, but because of that, I have contacted people in other states about how they do things. And I found that in Vermont, the election official that was in charge split the poll worker shift into three parts. And part A was morning, part B was afternoon, and part C was evening. And the poll workers had to work two of the three shifts. And if you had seniority, you'd get your pick of shifts. But nobody had to work this brutal 14-hour day. I wouldn't volunteer to be a poll worker because of the 14-day requirement. So I know that's why you're not getting the volunteers. And you can't just go say, I'm going to change it in my county, because it's state law that it has to be all day. But we need to get the state to change it, because what we're asking people to do of 14 hours is just totally unreasonable, especially on a job they're not used to.
Thank you. Yes. And if everyone can, because we're recording this, if you can speak into the mic, we want to make sure that we capture all of this. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Robbie from Geauga County Board of Elections. It's hard enough to get 500 people. How do you suggest we get 1,500 people? But, you know, it used to be Election Day was a holiday. The schools were closed. Government offices were closed. We had a huge pool of workers that we could tap. The school teachers in our county are not permitted to even take a personal day to work as a poll worker. I think we need to free up some of those people so that we can use them on Election Day. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to jump over to the panel now in case there's some comments on a lot of the information that's been shared. Debbie?
I totally respect what you're saying about trying to not work that 14-hour day, but anybody that's in the office at 5 o'clock on Election Day and your phone's ringing because there's not going to be poll workers there knows how hard it is to get them there for one shift, let alone two. I don't see three happening. So, I was reading a little bit in the report where it was kind of suggested maybe we go to a split shift. I don't know how everyone else feels, but I know from me working in the office and with Penny and the problems we have, I just don't see the split shift working.
Let me ask a question about it, about a split shift, because it seems to me one potential problem that's created is the transition from one shift to another, and then the responsibility for closing out at the end of the day, and if there's a problem and an error, when did it happen? And I don't know that you want to lead to a system where you close out three times in a day and transfer over to a new shift. So it seems to me a reasonable compromise between split shifts and a 14-hour day is somehow coming up with the funding and the ability to over-recruit enough to have extra poll workers that allows for extended breaks, at least, so that people don't work straight for 14 hours. They get to take a couple of long breaks during the day and get off, you know, get away from the pressure of it all. But that's just a thought.
Thank you, Quinn. Kathy, weigh in.
Thanks. I would go back to something that Debbie talked about earlier, and that's the high school seniors. That was a great law. How many here use high school seniors? They've been so well received. I would point out the potential for conflict when you do have, you probably are well aware of that, with when you have a school ballot, a school levy issue. But we have more colleges per capita, I think, than any other state in the country. So I think we have to deal with the residence issue, but I think beyond that issue and dealing with colleges, that we should also be approaching colleges as well as the high school seniors.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Nora Rose, and I was Director of Voter Protection for the Ohio Democratic Party, but before that, I actually co-authored a guidebook on recruiting college poll workers with the Election Assistance Commission. And that's a really good guidebook, and it's out there, and you can get it for free, and it provides all sorts of ideas. And it's based on three pilot programs that we ran. The most successful, actually, was in Cleveland at Cleveland State University. One of the things that made it so successful was how engaged the university was and the Board of Elections was. And there was a point person in each place, a champion at the university, really pushing the kids to become poll workers. Professors built it into their curriculum. They taught issues related to election administration, and they managed to recruit, I think, 250 college students in 2006. So they also gave the kids a day off in order to be a poll worker. So I really would like to, you know, encourage
you. Give the name of the publication again.
It's called Guide to College Poll Worker Recruitment. And if you look it up on the website of the Election Assistance Commission, it's there. And there is,
if you go to www.eac.gov, and then, yeah, I think it's in the resources section.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's an associated regular guide to recruiting regular poll workers, not just college poll workers. But both guides have an awful lot to offer. It's all sort of synthesized, and it's based on a lot of research, a year of research. I also want to just talk for a second about poll worker training. And I'm wondering how many counties actually use the Secretary of State's training materials. And, but I'm wondering whether that data is being, you know, collected so we have a sense of how widely they're being distributed. They are great. How much they're being used to ensure that sort of consistency. And I'd love to hear any commentary on that material and how it helped.
Thank you, Dora. We're going to, since that kind of segues into one of our issue areas of discussion, poll worker training enhancements. Dora mentioned the online training tool, and I know it looked like maybe about 50% raised their hands to the counties that are using that. So if anybody would like to speak to Dora's question on the HAVA Partners online poll worker training. Yes.
Cheryl Browning from Jackson County. We didn't use the online training yet. We are planning on using it this year for the first time. But the stuff that the Secretary of State sent out last year for the flip chart, it was amazing. Our poll workers absolutely loved it. And she sent enough for us that we could give each one of them a copy at the training session and send us more so that we could send them to the polls with them. So if someone did not remember it. And, you know, we get boxes on top of boxes of all of this stuff that just piles up. And for a change, it was nice to get something that we could actually use.
I'd just like to say, ask how many people use the flip chart that they provided. Wasn't that great? Our poll workers loved it. It was simple. It was wonderful.
To add something else, I think that our numbers of provisional ballots this past election that were thrown out because of things that were not put on there was much smaller. And I think a lot of it had to do with that flip chart because it was step by step what they could use and what they could not use.
Thanks, Cheryl. Yeah, Brian.
Yes, thank you. My name is Brian Williams from Summit County. I also want to echo the value of the flip chart. It was the first piece of training material that really worked because so oftentimes, even like the online training, although the information may be accurate, it's stuff that you only have so many bites at the apple. You only have so much of a window of time in order to train your booth workers. And if you're going to inundate them with a 2-hour online training program or 1 hour, and it's not the critical stuff that you need to get them to know, then you've used up your training time in an area where it's not real helpful. But the flip charts were very helpful. The booth workers were able to read them during the election day, digest them, and they were in a readable format, so I do want to compliment that process. But the reason I stood up was to also to respond to something Quinn Monson said, and that is, in the 5 years I've been working on booth worker recruitment, we've tried everything that was in those panels. We use high school students, we use county and city employees that get to be paid without taking a day off. We've gone to fairs and had our community outreach people hand out applications. We've done everything. The thing that we had the greatest success was last year sending 1,000 letters to Republicans and 1,000 letters to Democrats. We screened our voter database with just what you said, people who vote frequently, and we sent them out. And we got a big response from it. In fact, we're thinking about doing it again this year, and you could target it to the areas where you have a dearth of one political subdivision. If you're weak here in one party and weak there in another party, you could target it. So it was very helpful. It allowed us to bring in new poll workers at our pace. They were pre-screened by party affiliation already. They were kind of pre-qualified. That was very helpful. And the other reason I know that your theory about going to high-frequency voters works is because we made the mistake of not screening out existing booth workers. And so we got a disproportionate phone number phone call from people saying, hey, what are you recruiting me for? I'm already a booth worker. And they thought we were going behind their backs to replace them in their precinct. And so when we do this next time, we're going to screen out existing booth workers in our universe. But we do know that frequently people who vote with a high frequency, if you have 4 or 5 elections a year and you've got a voter in that jurisdiction that votes 4 or 5 times and they're affiliated with a party, it helped considerably. And these are people who are interested in the process. And so I just wanted to validate that from our experience.
And Brian, you said you did get a large return, and so you think it justified the expense, the cost of the mailing? And
well, yeah, if a letter cost you 50 cents out the door, it was a form letter, mail merged off of our voter registration database. I mean, if the postage is 42 cents plus whatever the printing cost is, it was an easy letter to put together and screen for. If you send out 2,000 letters, you're looking at $1,000, and if you get 100 to 150 new booth workers in a particular election, and they stay year to year, it's a beautiful thing. I mean, it was well worth it. We probably had, I would say realistically, we probably did put to work 150 new booth workers out of that mailing, although we didn't track the number we actually employed or brought into training. And it was probably more Republicans than Democrats, but that's okay because we needed more of them. So it worked for us.
So you're suggesting there was a close to a 15% capture from the letter you sent
out?
Yes,
yes.
Yeah, and I would, if you sent it just to a random sample of voters not screened for regular voters, I would guess that would be much lower, probably closer to 2% or 1% or something.
Right, the utility
where this
bill
is a much better payoff than putting something in the utility bill.
The utility bill stuff goes to everybody.
Yeah, that goes to everyone. That targeting is the key here.
And we've got that idea from Maryland. The state of Maryland did something like that in 2004, and it was in the newsletter, that bulletin that we subscribed to, and they said they had success with it. And so we kicked it around for a few years. We finally did it. We had success with it.
Great. Thanks, Brian. This gentleman just said he thinks it was 7.5% return.
Yeah, 2,000 letters. Right, 2,000.
Oh, okay.
About 7.5%. That's a good return. Bad.
The other thing I was going to just point out, too, is that the other way to find poll workers by screening is to ask your existing poll workers to find somebody. When we did these surveys, we found that about a third of all poll workers are recruited by another poll worker. And obviously, you know, there's a tremendous amount of literature on the appeal, the benefits of face-to-face contacts in getting people to vote and things like that. So you can imagine a face-to-face communication asking you to be a poll worker from somebody who is a poll worker is also going to be a very beneficial thing. So you could probably identify people through your existing poll workers.
Yes, to the far right, if you want to step up to the mic.
Hi, I'm Jane Barnett from Butler County. We participated in the online training when we first built, and we found that to be a useful tool. But I wanted to talk about mailing. What we've gone through in the last few years of our targeted mailings, we've done a funnel type analysis of who stays with us. Last year it was very different because people were very excited about the presidential. But our return on investment, when you look at how much it costs to mail, is not that much. How much it costs to train, okay? Send the letter back to them, ask them to work. You start to see a real funnel approach to the mailing costs that people that you get by mail, mm-hmm. these random mails. They do not stay as long. They do it the first time because it sounds easy. They have no idea what they're doing. And then you come back and say, hey, great, this is where we're going to have you work the next time. And they're like, I had no idea about that. One specific area that we have found that is a really good target are professional people who have recently retired. Hmm. And they have computer skills, you know, they have organizational skills, et cetera. They aren't sure what they're doing in their new life. And so, of course, we work with our poll workers for other people, but we try to work demographically to see the areas and people who have recently retired. And those were the ones that tended to come back, because they're looking for things to do in the community now.
Jane, how do you find them? Yeah. How do you identify them as a target? Is there a way you use, a technique you use?
It's extremely difficult, but we look at the age. First, we start looking at the age level, okay? And we also picked demographically, but we have to have them in all demographic areas. But then we have questionnaires. And then when people send back, the ones that we're more likely to ask to come to training are those that have certain characteristics. We don't have everybody come to training. If it doesn't look like they would potentially be a good long-term poll worker.
So you screen them with a questionnaire that
yes.
allows you to know some probability that they're going to stick with it, basically.
Yeah, because we already have 11% of our complete poll worker amount are high school seniors. 17. So we know of that 11% of our poll worker group, the high school seniors, we get less than 1.5% of those that come back the next year. So the churn rate, we love the kids and we continue to use them because we can't run an election without them. But the churn rate on the kids is, they don't come back. A lot of them hopefully are going to college or getting jobs, et cetera. So yeah, we use a screening questionnaire when we do our mailings. Also the more that we explain about the day and what we expect and how long it is, et cetera, in that letter, it helps screen out some people. So that's just, trying to look at that long-term rate of people who'll stay with you is also, you got to look at that, I think, in a financial comparison.
Right. Well, and I think that's an excellent point, not only recruitment, but retention, keeping your good poll workers.
Kelly?
Yes, ma'am.
The public retirement plan, state teachers' retirement plan, those plans, it's public information. And I don't know if it's divided by recent, if they have their computer program laid out so you can get the recent retirees, but I know in running campaigns, I've gotten lists of all retirees, all teachers in a certain community. They can provide it by county. A lot of lists are subject to privacy laws, and you cannot get them, but by statute, those are public laws, or public records, so you can obtain them.
Thanks, Kathy. I know we had some more hands up. Crawford County, step right up.
I'm Joe Swain, and I'm a board member. I have no idea what all they go through in the office. I'll preface my remarks with that. School teachers, to get retired school teachers, and I do that, all you have to know is one teacher. They tell you who's going to be off next year, so that works. High school kids are great, and I used them before the law was passed because I got the 18-year-old seniors, and they work, and they're great, and they're not afraid of the machines, and they come back, and they ask their professors for that class to be excused, and they work too. But we address poll workers at every conference that I go to, and we miss what I think is the obvious. We all know we don't pay them enough, and we talk about a 14-hour day, and I got news for you. There is no such thing when you work. You get up at 4 or 4:30 in the morning to be there at 5:30. The poll closes at 7:30, and you're lucky if you're home by 9. Lucky. Now, why do we have to have the polls open so long? We did a study some years ago. We had to keep a record of who all voted in the last hour. I know people, and everybody in this room knows people, who say, wow, I got to go vote. It's 2 o'clock. Well, I got time yet. And those people are going to vote in the last 1 hour, whether the precinct closed at 2:30 in the afternoon or midnight. They're going to vote in the last 1 hour. Now we have no-fault absentee voting. Why can't we have a 9 or a 10-hour voting day? And why don't we lobby for something like that? Because if you have to go to work at 6 in the morning and work until 6 at night, vote absentee.
Thank you. We have time for two more questions or suggestions on any of the issues we've discussed thus far before we go on to the next topic. Norman Robbins.
I think it's great, the efforts on training, but I think we have to know some data, which is that provisional ballots rejected for wrong precinct reasons have not gone down despite in 08 compared to 04 or 06. They have not gone down. And we all know that a poll worker should be telling voters, look, if you vote here, it's not going to count under Ohio law. So therefore, all of those provisional ballots, it's a large number, means to me that there's not enough poll worker training. I have two quick things to suggest. First, that I know some counties do experiments with this, like Cuyahoga County had a specific provisional ballot desk. And we should see whether efforts like that have success or don't. And secondly, we should target training for poll workers if we're not going to change the law to places like this that are persistent errors. We're not making headway on that. That's the facts. Those are the numbers. And three, come to the provisional ballot group where perhaps we can get enough consensus on changing the law, which would be the best of all, in my opinion. Thank you.
Thank you, Norman. Did we have a question? This gentleman was waiting on recruitment and training. And Norman, we're going to get back to yours in just a second on the final issue.
Hi, Jake Schlachter. I understand that some counties might have seniority guidelines, so that even if you were able to recruit a large number of new blood, you might not use all of them in favor of people that have been doing it for a long time. So anyway, I've heard of this. I don't know how many counties represented in the room might have policies like this, but there may be things that are kind of discouraging being able to recruit new folks to the process.
Debbie or Kathy, do either of you do that? Is there a county that, Summit County?
Yes.
You all do that?
My name is Brian Daly, Summit County Board of Election. Just a question. The speaker just before the fellow who just spoke indicated that we have problems with poll worker error. How do we know that, in fact, it's poll worker error? How do we know that the voter didn't make a mistake? I mean, this is a curiosity question on my part. I mean, has there been some work done to identify errors that are made by poll workers and errors that are made by the voters themselves?
Just a question.
I'll put that out to the panel, and I want to go ahead and move into kind of the final area of focus, and Norman touched on it. It actually has been touched on in previous panels today, and I think everybody has talked a little bit about elections administration and how that impacts poll worker recruitment and training. So we'll go ahead and talk about that a little bit. And the issue discussed is, do we simplify elections administration expectations for poll workers? How can streamlining the voting experience improve poll worker retention? And would changes to voter ID, provisional balloting, and paperwork ease the burden? So we'll address if anyone knows of any kind of research and data that speaks to what Mr. Daly said and also to Norman Robbins' point. I'll put that out to the panel to start.
Maybe I'm wrong, but my understanding is the most common error on provisional ballots is that somebody votes in the wrong precinct. They come in and they say, this is my address, I've moved, I didn't register, and then they vote a provisional ballot in that precinct, and that precinct is not where their address is located. And we're not getting to the heart of the issue of whether the poll worker didn't want to argue with the voter, didn't look at the map or the street. I'm always amazed in my new small rural county where they don't even have to look at a map or a street finder. They know where all the lines are and they can say, no, you need to go over there to that other poll, or no, you need to go down to such and such a school or somewhere. But I mean, but that to me is a poll worker error. I'm assuming they're not coming in saying, I have a certain address, and then they sit down and put a different address on a provisional ballot when they fill it out. It's poll worker error. If you give a poll worker an address and they let you vote in the wrong precinct, get them to the right one.
Right. I agree with what Kathy's saying. I know we broke ours down in November. Our number one group of provisionals that did not count were they were not registered, which I do not feel is a poll worker error. I feel that's a voter error. Our second largest group was people that come in and voted in the wrong precinct.
Unfortunately, were reversed, and I think the statistics are reversed from you.
Yeah. And well, we've worked very hard on it, and unfortunately, I consider this a poll worker error. When we're in training, we tell them this. We tell them, you are the first line of defense for this voter's ballot to count. You've got to quit letting them vote if they're in the wrong precinct. What Penny and I are going to do, what we did from November, we in no way want to embarrass the poll worker, but I think poll workers, they do it by accident. They want to know if they've made a mistake. We've kept track of it. We broke them down. We know what presiding judge let people vote. We're going back to those presiding judges, and we're going to tell them, here's what you did, here's what happened, here's how many. We had a precinct that allowed 12 people to vote in one precinct, and we're going to set her down and talk to her about it. We don't know if this will work, but we're going to try it.
It's recommended in the report exactly what Debbie's talking about, to look for your problem precincts and make sure you have someone there. And this is what I talked about earlier, the role-playing, the filling out provisional ballots, the just learning how to properly, lots of times I think it's the desire not to be confrontational. If somebody's in there demanding to want to vote there, they think it's easier to let them vote than to say, you can vote here if you want, but your vote isn't going to count. And I think once you get the words out, your vote's not going to count, people start taking a different attitude. Because by state law, if you vote in the wrong precinct, your vote does not count, period. You're not for president, not for governor, no part of your vote counts. You have to be in the correct precinct for voting. Or go to the board. And that's always the other option, but of course, the size of the counties and where the board's located makes a big difference.
One thing I want to address before we move on, just so we're all on the same page. In every county, the statistics were a little bit different, but the secretary just sent out the provisional report. Top three reasons disqualifying provisional. The first one is voter not registered in the state, 47, give or take percent. Voter registered in state, but this speaks to what you were talking about, Kathy, voted in the wrong county or precinct. About 35%, and third was failure to provide acceptable identification. Just want to make sure we had those.
Are the Quinn? Numbers gathered uniformly by counties? I mean, is there a uniform reporting of these errors?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. I can send you that, Quinn.
I'm just going to make one quick point, which is that, they're related points. One is that this is a point where you do need to be kind of engaging in post-election auditing of your problem precincts to identify where you're having these problems and then feeding that back into your management system of how you're gonna make things work better. The other point though is that there's a huge literature right now in medicine on the benefits of checklists. So it turns out that when you put in a central line in somebody, there are like six steps, and it turns out that people blow one of those six steps about 25% of the time. And they cause infections and they cause costs. And they turned out if you have a five-step checklist, you can drive down your errors to zero. And they've done the same thing with surgery. If you had a checklist that had a picture, that even if it had like a, so it told the poll worker, this person wants to vote provisional. And the first thing was, are they in the precinct? If they're not, you hand them a piece of paper that says, the voter piece of paper that says, you're in the wrong precinct. Here's what you're giving up. Your vote will not count. Are you aware of this? And then you just went through and made sure they got the ID, they filled out the form. I checked that they filled out the form. And then at least you would have documentation that this had happened. And the poll worker wouldn't be thinking, oh, I have this provisional ballot. You know, it's hurry. They would go through and they could just check off those five boxes. No, they got all the information. And then when people screw it up, you could say, wait a second, I made this as easy as I could. You know, and then you can fire them and use all these techniques for getting people.
Right. And that's point is excellent. The checklist, and as many of you all know, our office sent out the problem with, and this gets back to the election administration and the complex rules, we did a flow chart, and you cannot, well, I won't say that. I know we have asked the best and the brightest to come up with a way to narrow it down to be at the five or six in a really basic, it couldn't fit on the same page. So I think we're kind of back to some more discussion on election administration. Is there a way to ease that? What would you suggest, particularly for poll worker recruitment and retention? Yes, ma'am.
My name is Betsy. I'm from Clinton County Board of Elections. And I think one thought that I have is really the whole process really needs to be streamlined. I mean, at the last summer conference, I forget what session it was, but I started sitting there, and within just a couple of minutes, starting to go through the process and thinking of all the things that we ask presiding judges to do. Yes. And, you know, in about probably a couple of seconds, you know, I was up to like 16 things. And they're not all things that are even going on right in front of them at the same table. We're asking them to make sure that, you know, what the observers are doing and what this person's doing, what's going on outside. What about your ADA? They're asked to do so much And their main job ought to be processing the voter that's in front of them in the line and making sure that that's done correctly. But we've got them so spastic about all these things they have to do. Plus, you're taking people that do this maybe once or twice a year, and every election we throw all these new things at them to learn. They get confused about what are we doing, what are we not doing, what's new, and you know, we try to train them in 2 hours or 4 hours or whatever in one day. And you know, I mean, we get all these things thrown at us, and I think, you know, I mean, we have a hard time, you know, making sense of some of it. So what are they supposed to do when they get it in 2 hours? And the other thing is that sometimes people talk about with the judges and so forth, you can't, you know, you kind of look at it in an isolated situation of the judge working with this one voter. They're in a situation where they've got people standing there, you know, humming and hawing and hurry up and hurry up. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot of pressure on them as far as, you know, just the whole dynamics in the polling place. You can't, it's not as easy as it seems sometimes to people. It's really complicated.
Thank you, Betsy. If I could ask, just by a show of hands from our election officials, because I think we're hearing this, how many believe that you either lose poll workers or you have trouble recruiting them because of all that's expected of them and all they have to know? Okay, as I suspected, I would like to throw this to, because I know Thad and Quinn have both studied other states' attitudes towards poll workers and voting. Is this a common thing in other places?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, the other thing, too, is, you know, there was some state legislator who said he was going to listen to all of you. So you should make a list of all the things you can't explain to poll workers on a page with six boxes and send him a list and say, look, you know, if I can't explain to my poll workers how to do a provisional ballot because it's three pages of a flow chart, you know, you should be talking to your legislators. Because
that flow chart is very hard to follow.
Because when the party in the house.
But it was very helpful to him, though.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Following, we're kind of throwing in some things that go along, not really recruiting, but provisional voting. Provisional voting, the reason it started out was when it was called a walk-in was because you didn't change your address. How many reasons do we have now? We're up to, what, 16? If I changed my name, I live in the same precinct. If I did not change my name, I live in the same precinct. I walk in, I want to vote. I no longer fill out a simple registration card, change a name. I vote provisional. We've made it way too hard. It's way too complicated for our presiding judges. We have way too many reasons on the provisional voting. So we really need to get someone to help us with that, to streamline that. The last lady that was up, she summed it up so well on what we expect out of these presiding judges.
It all stems from fear of fraud, and we just heard at the legislative luncheon, one legislator who's working on the current bill who wants to implement even more preventing fraud provisions. And it's weighing it out. Okay. I think we've created a very complex situation that's not resolving any fraud problem.
Talking about fraud, we're Athens County, so we have a high university. We always have someone that double votes. In November, we had a young lady that double voted. When we turned her over to the prosecutor, they went and talked to her. Do you know what happened? How many of you had problems with observers being too aggressive this time? We were overwhelmed with them. She went in and voted provisional like she should have. She came out, an observer told her her vote would not count. She needed to go back to where she was registered from. Well, she went there and the poll worker let her vote. They didn't know. So we had problems with observers too.
Okay.
Mr. Mallory?
I just wanted to say, one of the gentlemen asked, how do we know that the person voted in the wrong precinct? And the poll workers, they don't intentionally do it, but they tell us. They write on the notes page, I made a mistake. I sent this person to the wrong precinct. They tell us that in the notes pages. But the law says that it can't be counted. You know, so that's one thing. One thing that we use to recruit our poll workers is we use the media to get the word out. Mm-hmm. We have war chairs in the old party system. The Democrats and Republicans, the war chairs, identify people that they give us names of that we can assign to the poll. That helps us a lot. And then we also have the media, and when we put a blast out, that creates a lot of work for the poll worker coordinators because you get thousands of phone calls. Everybody wants to be a poll worker. And then you got to sift them out and all that kind of stuff. Right. You have the college poll worker program, but we have a survey that we give our poll workers at the end of the election. How do you think you did? Where do you think you need more help in training? Do you need more help on the equipment, the procedures, provisional? You know, whatever. What do you think you need more training on? So we can focus on where the problems are for them so that we can get them the help that they need.
And out of that, out of curiosity, what would be the kind of number one thing they say that they need more of or that would better able them to serve the voters?
Provisional and ID.
Okay, streamlined.
You know, provisional is so confusing for all of them. You'd like, attorneys can't even figure that out.
And is it the issue it's too complex?
I'm sorry for all the attorneys.
It's too complex.
No, but that's enough that you have.
So we created cheat sheets for some of these items to try to help expedite the process. Online trading didn't work for us. The flip charts, some of the things didn't apply to us, so we didn't use that. But, you know, we have a four-hour training class we give them, and that's a lot of information to absorb, and you only do it once a year. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you're going to have turnover constantly.
All right. Thank you. And we have time for one more question. Yes,
one
sir?
One more question. I'm Tom from Huron County. Maybe several of the things might be taken care of if every other year, every single legislator was a poll worker.
Yes.
Maybe they would understand.
Okay, and I'm going to end with an interactive exercise. By a show of hands, how many people think that's a good idea? Raise your hands. I want to thank you all very much for coming today. I want to, of course, thank the audience, and a big round of applause for our fantastic panel.